So what I want to visit with you over the next more or less 40 minutes is are several things relative to, to lead off, some management considerations related primarily to fixed time AI for both beef cows and heifers. I'll follow that with then more or less an overview of discussion relating to the protocols specifically for timed AI as it relate to heifers and cows, and then given the length of the presentation, we'll probably have to postpone questions and discussion till later because we'll be around here over the course of the next 2 days. So I want to start off with more or less a kind of a some of the management considerations related to estrus synchronization and fixed time AI. And for those of you that have never time bred cattle before, I think this was one of the questions when we began a lot of our work in Missouri, as was the case, I think, in terms of a lot of the colleagues that have worked in this area. This was by far and away the question that we received most. Everyone understood that if you were going to appointment breed cattle at a fixed time on a specific day, what was it going to occur on that day? But in many cases, the question that arose was what's going to happen at calving time. And so we actually conducted a series of trials where we had an opportunity to evaluate that. All of the cows that are represented on these various panels represent groups of cows that conceived on a particular day of the breeding season to a specific sire. Cleanup bulls did not re-enter those or enter those breeding pastures until 2 weeks following the appointment breeding. Pregnancies were confirmed by ultrasound and then as well confirmed by calving date. But what you can see here in each of these panels is the actual distribution based on those particular sets of cows. And the green bar in each of those panels represents day 283 of gestation. And so you can see the relative distribution or calving pattern before and following day 283. But if you boil the data down, essentially what we found was that if we look at the peak number of, or the maximum number of cows that calved on the peak day of the calving season for all the groups that we evaluated, and we've essentially stopped doing this now because it more or less told the story early on, was that if we breed 100 cows on a given day and we get 60% of those cows to conceive, essentially the maximum number of cows that have calved on the peak day of the calving season is right around 20%. So if we breed 100 cows, 60 of those cows conceive, and 20% of those cows calve on that peak day, we're talking about 12 cows calving on the peak day of the calving season. And so essentially what we've seen over the years is that in feedback that we've received from herd managers is that it really has improved in many cases what occurs in terms of management during the calving season as opposed to stringing things out. So I also want to talk briefly about the impact of estrus synchronization on calving distribution. And Harlan Hughes, who's an economist that writes for Beef Magazine that many of you probably follow, reported, you know, a number of years ago that increased profits in cow-calf operations really stem from moving later calving cows forward toward the first and second calving intervals, and that high production herds see 61% of the cows calving by day 21 of the calving season, 85% by day 42, and 94% by day 63. This is data that we collected several years ago looking at calving distribution patterns for an entire calving season. There's roughly 1,500 calvings represented here, and essentially all the cows that are illustrated or shown on this graph had one opportunity at appointment breeding, and then were, as I indicated earlier, the cleanup bulls did not enter those breeding pastures until 2 weeks following. And so everything was confirmed by ultrasound. But essentially what you can see is that if you boil the data down, the cumulative calf percentage by day 15 was 65%, by day 21, 70%, by day 30, 82%, and by day 42, 93%. And so the take-home message here is that aside from having the opportunity to really improve the genetic makeup of your herd via artificial insemination and selection of superior sires, as far as I'm concerned, one of the really big benefits of synchronization programs in general is the opportunity to really enhance or improve reproductive management. This is a herd that we work with. My students and I work very closely with this herd in kind of north central Missouri, the Thompson Research Center. It's a commercial Angus herd. What's illustrated here is the cumulative calf crop over the first 46 days during 12 calving seasons. And essentially, if you look at that red line, before we began our work up there in the late 90s, essentially the herd was managed, very well managed, but no synchronization or AI was being utilized. The blue line then illustrates what occurred as a result of imposing a synchronization program on that herd. And inseminations were actually performed with the aid of heat watch. So we had a 24-hour round-the-clock heat detection opportunity to really more appropriately identify cows that were coming into heat. And that shift from the red line to the blue line really was to be expected, because imposing a synchronization program on those cows really afforded us the opportunity to tighten that calving interval up and move those cows further to the left relative to when they calved. What really actually surprised us, however, was what occurred with that purple line, and that's when we went strictly to appointment breeding the cows. So the cows all have one opportunity at timed AI, and then 10 days to 2 weeks later, cleanup bulls go into that herd. And so it's really enhanced what we've seen occur over time relative to reproductive management within that particular operation. This is a really nice data set from Cliff Lamb at the University of Florida. And when Cliff joined the faculty at Florida and at the station at Mariana, basically what he had an opportunity to do was more or less something similar to what was done at Thompson. But I think the important take home here is he actually put some economics to it. And if you look at when they began imposing more constraints relative to their breeding management within that herd, essentially using timed insemination and then shortening up the calving period, essentially what you can see is, as you track across those various rows, the change relative to mean calving day in that second row of numbers, beginning with, you know, roughly an 80 days of the calving season in terms of the mean calving day. And in 2013, you can see they had reduced that to 38.7 days. You jump down then to the per calf increase in value and follow that along in terms of how much they increase the value of the calves coming out of that operation, and then the herd increase in value relative to enhancements in reproductive management. And so a lot of what we see occurring in herds that are really using these technologies more aggressively is the fact that, again, going back to the point that we're improving genetics most definitely, you know, by choosing the correct or appropriate sires to fit into that management system. But I think one of the big opportunities, again, is just simply an improvement in concentrating those herds relative to calving date. So I want to talk to you now so relative to some considerations in terms of heifer management. And I think you'll probably hear this over the course of the next 2 days. When we're talking about managing heifers, going back to early data in the 1970s, we really have a pretty good understanding that those heifers that conceive earliest during that first breeding season tend to stay in the herd longer and over their productive lifetimes produce more pounds of beef during that time frame. And I think one of the things that we've done in Missouri with our heifer program is we've more or less tried to outline some key considerations in terms of what occurs or should occur prior to that first breeding season. And most definitely, you know, that has to begin with a sound health, herd health platform to set those heifers up for long-term reproductive health. But one of the key components of our program is that all heifers have to go through a pre-breeding exam. And so we evaluate where those heifers are at developmentally in terms of reaching target weights, perhaps. But every heifer in our program has to go through a reproductive exam that involves a track score and a pelvic exam. Most of the heifers in our program, and if you visit the Show Me Select booth, you can see some of the statistics generated from the program. Most of the heifers are now going through a synchronization and AI program, and then we pay very close attention to sire selection. But I want to talk about the track scores, because as far as I'm concerned, the work that we've done over the years in herds, not just in Missouri, but other herds across the country that I have an opportunity to interact with, one of the questions that comes up is oftentimes what occurs after the breeding season. And in some situations, we're called when failures arise. And so if you don't have any framework or reference point in terms of where those heifers were at going into the breeding season, and you do have problems, you really don't have any numbers to really work with to assess where those heifers were at developmentally. And so the reproductive track scoring system, as far as I'm concerned, is a useful tool to really assess that. The scores range from 1 to 5. In terms of cycling status, a track score 1 heifer is a heifer that more or less is, at the time of the exam, identified to have an infantile track. Score of 2 indicates that the heifer is probably greater than a month out from reaching puberty. A score of 3, those heifers are within a month. 4s and 5s indicate that those heifers are actually cycling, but in different stages of the cycle. So a 4 would indicate that the heifer's in the follicular phase of the cycle, and a 5 is in the luteal phase. And obviously, when whoever is doing the exams on these heifers, those determinations are based on uterine horn diameter and tone, as well as palpable structures on the ovaries. And so I think from our perspective, in terms of the heifer program in Missouri, it's one of the reasons why we've seen the significant growth in AI, because in many cases, I think we're seeing increased success rates because of the fact that we're synchronizing heifers that are better set up to succeed in those programs. If you really consider what's occurring from an endocrine standpoint, it really makes a lot of sense in terms of assignment of those track scores. And if you look at more or less the changes in endocrine secretion patterns over time relative to each of these scores, it really makes a lot of sense from a physiological standpoint. As you increase palpable structures on the ovary relative to follicular dynamics and follicular size and growth. But the other point that I need to highlight here is the fact that it affords you the opportunity to identify heifers that perhaps were purchased and are intended to breed. And I think one of the things that we realized early on when I was doing this back in the 90s, and there was a lot of advocacy or recommendations coming out to use implants on heifers to increase pelvic growth and reduce calving difficulty. And one of the things we found in a lot of those heifers was, from a phenotypic standpoint, a lot of those heifers look great developmentally, but you get inside those heifers and essentially what you find are really underdeveloped reproductive tracts. And there's some really good work out of Auburn University's vet school to indicate that implanting those heifers during the suckling period at critical times really leaves or can create the situation where glandular development in the uterus really is impaired permanently. And so, again, from that perspective, if you're purchasing heifer calves in to develop and breed, I think that's one of the questions should be asked. But I think in addition to that, the exam should be considered in terms of evaluating those heifers. So timing is a big deal in terms of when those track scores should be done, roughly 4 to 6 weeks before breeding or 2 weeks before synchronization. You don't want to jump in too early on these heifers, because that's the critical time to evaluate them to where you can make some adjustments if you need to. And in our hands, what we recommend to our producers is that heifers or sets of heifers are ready to synchronize or place on a treatment or protocol when roughly 50% of those heifers are track scoring 4 and 5. If you're down in the 20 to 30% range relative to heifers track scoring 4 and 5, those heifers are underdeveloped. They're either underdeveloped from a nutritional standpoint, or they're perhaps maybe simply too young to fit into the breeding season you're trying to get them into. So I want to talk very briefly about some of the MGA-based protocols for heifers. And this is some of the early work that I was involved with along with some other groups. And the 7-day MGA prostaglandin protocol was developed more or less, or was evaluated more or less, coincident with the development of the 14-day protocol. And this following slide really characterizes some of the problems or considerations related to use of that protocol. Because when you feed MGA for a period of 7 days and follow with prostaglandin on day 7, you've got two populations of females. You've got heifers that are regressing their CLs as a result of administration of prostaglandin on day 7, but you've got another group of heifers that have actually regressed their CLs during MGA feeding. And what this slide illustrates is more or less the concept of persistent follicles, in that each of the heifers that are illustrated in this graph, we actually knew stage of cycle of those heifers at the time MGA feeding began. And so what you can see is that those heifers that regress their CLs in response to prostaglandin in terms of those earlier or earlier bars, day 1 through 5 and 6 through 11, essentially those were coming into heat in response to administration of prostaglandin. Their pregnancy rates were good. However, those heifers that were later in their cycles and actually regressed their CLs during MGA feeding, essentially their fertility was compromised. And so it really began to illustrate the problems you can run into in terms of breeding on that first heat following withdrawal if they have actually regressed their CLs. So what really came about at that time was development of the 14-day program that Ken Otey's group developed at Colorado State University, where MGA is fed at a dosage of 0.5 milligram per animal per day for a period of 14 days, followed by prostaglandin 17 to 19 days later. And Cliff Lamb and Gene Deitcher really evaluated that protocol more thoroughly and realized that by waiting 2 additional days and moving that interval from 17 to 19 days really accomplished a couple things. It increased total estrus response and actually enhanced the degree of synchrony that you see following administration of that protocol. In situations where producers have never used AI and want to transition to it fairly gradually, this system works very effectively by feeding MGA for a period of 14 days, bypassing that subfertile estrus coming off of MGA, and then simply exposing those synchronized groups of heifers for natural service roughly 10 days after MGA withdrawal. And this is data that we collected when I was at the University of Kentucky, and there's data here illustrating pregnancy rates following administration of MGA prior to natural service or MGA prostaglandin prior to AI. And on the natural service heifers, you can see there's about 1,700 heifers. Those heifers essentially ended up with a synchronized pregnancy rate of 66%. The over 4,000 heifers that were exposed for AI were they received MGA and prostaglandin, and you can see that the pregnancy rate resulting from AI and heat detection was 57%. So both systems work very well if managed appropriately. This is more or less what occurs in terms of estrus distribution patterns following MGA prostaglandin versus MGA in natural service. MGA prostaglandin, the heats are going to be spread out over a period of 3 to 5 days, whereas MGA natural service with no prostaglandin, the heats are going to be spread out over a period of 7 to 10 days, which really, in a lot of respects, is more optimal relative to bulls entering those breeding programs. So I want to now move to a discussion of fixed-time AI protocols for heifers. And if you all have an opportunity to review the protocol sheets that are in the backs of all the AI stud books, essentially you'll see that there are 4 protocols currently being recommended by our task force and National Reproduction Leadership Team for use in replacement heifers. And so I want to take some time to kind of review those with you. So I want to begin first with the long-term protocols and how do those protocols compare in heifers. And begin with, to go back to the MGA protocol, which is really more or less the staple in many heifer programs across the country. And then compare that to the 14-day CEDAR, wherein CEDAR is inserted for a period of 14 days. So in other words, in on a Monday, out 2 weeks later on a Monday. And as you can see, the interval between CEDAR removal and prostaglandin is shortened in comparison to MGA to 16 days versus 17 or 19. So Daniel Mallory, a former graduate student in my program, was involved with a series of trials evaluating these protocols more or less head-to-head. And so in this particular instance, the comparison was made with heat detection involved and the heifers being inseminated on the basis of estrus detection. So essentially what we've had an opportunity to do is to actually evaluate estrus distribution patterns coming off of MGA or removal of the CEDAR. And what you can see is there's a much more robust expression of heat on those heifers coming off the CEDAR after the CEDARs were removed in comparison to withdrawal of MGA from the feed. And that's really to be expected based on how each of those products essentially clears the animal system. If we look at the distribution of estrus after prostaglandin that's illustrated on this graph, the black bars represent the MGA prostaglandin-treated heifers, whereas the gray bars represent the CEDAR-treated heifers. And although the profiles look very similar or comparable, essentially what you can see from this graph, if you run the numbers and do the statistics, is that the variance for interval to estrus, which is an indication of the degree of estrus synchrony, was actually significantly improved on the CEDAR-treated heifers versus the MGA-treated heifers. What we found, though, if you boil all that data down and compare the two protocols on the basis of two things, insemination performed on the basis of observed estrus, from Daniel's work, there was really no difference in synchronized conception or pregnancy rate. And work out of Rick Funston's lab at Nebraska really showed that there were no differences when those two protocols were put head-to-head relative to fixed-time AI. So the key to MGA, and we've done a huge amount of work over the years with MGA-based protocols, but I think the crux of the success that you're going to realize in using MGA is totally hinged on intake. Feeding it at the correct dosage once a day at the right, pretty much on a 24-hour interval, and making sure that you have adequate bunk space for those heifers. So I want to move now to the short-term protocols, and Cliff Lamb led the multi-state cedar trial, which really opened the door to use of the cedar in a much more extensive way, both in terms of heifers and cows. And the treatment protocols that were compared are illustrated on this panel, but essentially the protocols were all very similar that were compared. The top two you can see, in each case, all four protocols involved the 7-day cedar. But as you can see, the only difference in terms of actually how those treatments were administered was whether or not GnRH was administered at the time the cedars were inserted. The top two treatment groups involved a combination of estrus detection and appointment breeding, wherein the heifers were heat detected up to 84 hours, and then any of the non-responding heifers were inseminated by appointment at 84 hours. And then the bottom two panels, you can see, in those cases, each of those treatment groups involved straight appointment breeding at 60 hours for the heifers. When you boiled that data down, essentially what they found was that GnRH at cedar insertion did not improve pregnancy rates after fixed-time AI. GnRH at cedar insertion did not alter the percentage of heifers detected in estrus or the distribution of estrus after prostaglandin, and that a combination of detecting estrus in AI before cleanup AI actually enhanced pregnancy rates over the straight appointment bred heifers. So I want to move down to the 5-day COSYNC cedar protocol. And this is very similar in terms of design to the 7-day protocol. The only difference being that you can see the cedar is inserted for a period of 5 days versus 7. But what occurs relative to administration of this protocol is that when you administer GnRH at cedar insertion, you more or less create or cause the formation of an accessory CL. And when the cedar is only inserted for a period of 5 days, and you administer prostaglandin at the time cedars are removed on the 5th day, those CL are probably not capable of responding to a single injection of prostaglandin. So that's why a second injection administered roughly 8 hours later is necessary to effectively lyse that CL. So in this case, you can see the heifers are appointment bred at 60 hours. The data that's shown on this slide are the published data looking at pregnancy rates after fixed-time AI, comparing the 7-day COSYNC cedar versus the 5-day COSYNC cedar, and the bottom sets of or bottom rows of numbers compare the 14-day protocol with the 5-day protocol. The only significant differences that were reported in any of these published studies were in a study from, actually, I think, Virginia Tech, wherein there was a significant improvement in pregnancy rates resulting from fixed-time AI with the advantage to the 5-day treated heifers over the 7-day treated heifers. And as you can see, there were a little over 600 heifers involved in that trial. I wanted to share with you now, just a moment, some of the data that we've generated from the heifer program in Missouri, because it really affords us the opportunity to look at data retrospectively in our program to see how some of these protocols are performing, and to kind of evaluate systems based on field data. So this is data collected beginning back in 2010 up through the fall of 2015, looking at the relationship between reproductive tract score and fixed-time AI pregnancy rates on heifers in our program. And one of the things that we're fortunate in having is we've upgraded our database significantly to where we're able to more successfully track a lot of the data on heifers going through the program. But you can see there's a little over 23,000 heifers represented in this slide. And as you move from a track score 1 on up to a 5, you can see the significant increase in pregnancy rates resulting from fixed-time AI. essentially, the heifers in our program now, the Track Score 1, are eliminated before the breeding season, or not exposed for breeding, because the breeding success, whether those heifers are exposed for natural service or synchronized and AI'd on the basis of detected estrus or appointment bred, their performance in general is so abysmal that it really isn't worth retaining those heifers. If we break the protocols down by the three that are being used most extensively in our program, the 7-day co-sync plus cedar, MJ prostaglandin, and the 14-day cedar, and we group the twos and threes in terms of non-cycling heifers, and there's a little over 7,000 heifers, 7,400 heifers represented here, and then run the stats on those numbers, essentially what you can see is that the pregnancy rates on the non-cycling heifers on the 7-day co-sync cedar were 36%, 35% on MJ prostaglandin, and 46% on the 14-day cedar. And then as we move to the cycling heifers, there are about 16,000 heifers there. You can see the advantage there is still to the 14-day cedar. One of the things that we've seen in our program, because we have so many veterinarians that are instrumentally or very actively involved in the program, is they are becoming much more engaged in the entire reproductive management aspect of Show Me Select. And so the numbers that you saw on those previous two tables in large part are being driven by the veterinary community, because at the time those cedars go in, the vets can also administer the pre-breeding booster vaccinations. They can do the pre-breeding exams relative to the pelvics and track scores. And so it's more or less made somewhat of a one-stop shop. So the take-home points relative to heifers, the protocols work. The four protocols that are listed on the sheets appear in each of the bull books, which are updated annually. And I think Sandy Johnson will probably mention this in her presentation. But make sure when you're using those protocol sheets that you're referring to the current year. The year is listed at the top of each of those two pages, for one for heifers and one for cows, and we update those over time. And so you want to be referring to the most current year and hopefully the best information. The second point here is that choosing a protocol in heifers, I think, really should be based on pre-treatment determination of where those heifers are at from a reproductive development standpoint. And then one of the things that I think you really need to pay attention to, because all of us that work in this area continue to see problems relative to protocol compliance, if it's either product administration or timing of insemination. So I want to move now to cows. And so the two protocols that are listed on the cow sheet are the 7-day co-sync cedar protocol and the 5-day protocol. And our group at Missouri and then Dee Whittier at Virginia Tech conducted two field trials or studies evaluating these protocols as they appear on the sheets, more or less head-to-head. And in the case of the 5-day co-sync plus cedar protocol, essentially the point that needs to be made here is that the cows versus the heifers are inseminated at 72 hours. In the case of the 7-day treated cows, our group inseminated those cows at 66 hours. The data broken down within row for each of these two protocols represent the data that resulted from each of the two studies, the Missouri data as well as the Virginia Tech data. As you can see, with smaller numbers, the data in Missouri represented by the or highlighted in blue, essentially we came up with identical percentages. 67% of the cows in each treatment group became pregnant, no difference between treatments. But the data from Virginia Tech, you can see those cows were actually inseminated at 69 hours on the 7-day protocol. But there was a 3 percentage point advantage to the cows assigned to the 5-day protocol versus the 7. Sandy Johnson compiled a lot of the published data on the 5-day protocol with over 2,000 cows involved in those various studies, and when she put all that data together, essentially ended up with a 62% timed AI preg rate. And we actually, as a part of a USDA grant, inseminated over 7,000 cows in Missouri on 73 farms and ended up with a 62% pregnancy rate to appointment breeding as well. And so head-to-head, in most instances, those protocols perform very comparably. I think the point that needs to be made when you're considering choosing one versus the other is that The first point is that both work very effectively. I think you do need to, however, consider the extra drug use and trips to the chute that may be involved when administering the five-day protocol. So the take-home points in terms of cows, again, similar to the heifers, the protocols work. As Justin mentioned in his presentation, choosing a protocol for use in cows should take into consideration the cow age, the average number of days postpartum, the cow's body condition at the time those treatments are imposed, and then protocol compliance is, again, a critical consideration in terms of administering these appropriately, both in terms of product administration and timing of insemination. I want to just really quickly refer to some data now. It's actually presented on the, one of the posters out now in the foyer. But we had an opportunity this last year. Jill Abel, a graduate student in my program, was involved with a fairly extensive field trial involving specifically two-year-olds. And I think one of the things that's important about this trial in terms of consideration of managing two-year-olds is the fact that we all are well aware of the fact that rebuilding of the U.S. cow herd is really underway. And I think as we've seen an improvement or an increase, rather, in terms of use of synchronization and AI in replacement heifers, in many instances, what we see is that there's an opportunity to very definitely to really expand that to some of these younger cows as we move them into the cow herd. One of the other challenges, which Justin talked about, is the fact that when you consider all the challenges those young cows face, they all more or less culminate in many respects in reduced fertility in many situations. And so I think based on that, when we consider opportunities for young cows, in many cases, in these larger operations at least, a lot of these two-year-olds are managed as a separate management unit apart from the mature cow herds. And in addition to that, there really wasn't, when we conducted this study, any other studies that we were aware of that really specifically looked at two-year-olds as a group to see how these protocols might compare. So essentially, the goal of this effort was to more or less compare a short-term versus a long-term protocol. And so what we chose was the 7-day co-sync plus cedar protocol versus the 14-day cedar, with the idea being that the 14-day cedar might actually afford an opportunity to improve postpartum reproductive performance on these young cows. So the protocols were compared head-to-head. The cows and cows that are assigned to a 14-day protocol in comparison to heifers should be inseminated at 72 hours versus 66. But essentially, you can see the timing of treatment administration is illustrated on this slide. There were a little over 700 two-year-olds involved in this study. We had an opportunity, Stan Locke working with their group with Gen X, we had an opportunity to work with two large operations in southwestern Montana, in addition to the Thompson Research Center, where we're able to do some more intensive things that I really won't get into. You can visit Jill's poster. But essentially, you can see that we had roughly about 350 cows per treatment at the time that the treatment or the experiments for or the comparisons were made. The body condition scores of those cows were right around 5, and the average number of days postpartum was roughly 78, 79 days. These are the data. And so if you look at the breeding season overview, I want to first have you look at the differences between the two treatments based on estrus response. And one of the things that we've seen in time and time again relative to the 14-day cedar in cows is a diminished heat response in comparison to some of the other protocols. And so you can see here there's a significantly lower heat response in the 14-day cedar-treated cows versus the 7-day co-sync cedar. 43 versus 74% of those cows actually had exhibited estrus up to the point of fixed-time AI. But look at the pregnancy rates. There were really essentially no differences in terms of fixed-time AI pregnancy rates between the two treatments, 63 versus 64%. The number pregnant within the first 30 days of the breeding season, 87 versus 88, and pregnant by the end of the breeding season, 95 versus 96. So in our opinion, based on these data, essentially this creates a huge opportunity for some of these operations to really expand AI beyond heifers, especially in cases where those heifers were synchronized as yearlings. They calve over a fairly short period of time and then follow with that group as a separate management group to really broaden the use of synchronization and AI. So essentially, I think if you use either of these protocols based on these data, you're going to be satisfied with your results if those cattle are managed appropriately. I think you need to be prepared if you're using the 14-day protocol for a reduced heat response, but don't get too nervous. I think Jill can explain the rationale for some of that by visiting her poster. So the last thing I want to move into now is a brief discussion of split-time AI. And you'll have an opportunity to visit, again, some of the posters from some of the students in my program out here. But this is an area that we've sort of moved into as a result of some of the work that Jordan Thomas was involved with as part of his master's, to really try and identify opportunities to increase pregnancy rates beyond what we're realizing in situations where fixed-time AI is being implemented. And I think one of the things we need to begin with is to more or less begin a discussion or consideration where we have an opportunity to more or less think about fertility in females in relationship to timed AI breeding programs. And so when you consider a synchronized estrus, the thing that I think you need to understand that there are differing intervals from estrus to ovulation, and there's also differences in when females express estrus during that synchronized period. Some will have expressed estrus by the time their appointment bred and others will not. But I think one of the things you need to consider is that timing relative to when ovulation occurs. So from the onset of estrus to ovulation, we're talking about a period of 28 to 32 hours, and that perhaps may be extended a bit when we administer GnRH to those females that have not yet expressed estrus and we're inducing ovulation in. So one of the things you're going to hear a fair bit about over the next couple of days is the importance or significance of estrus as it relates to female fertility. And a lot of that is dependent upon estradiol and the significance estradiol plays relative to coordinating a number of important processes that really contribute to both establishment and maintenance of pregnancy. Cows that exhibit estrus prior to fixed-time AI have greater serum estradiol concentrations. And the other thing that we know is that in most cases, the exception being what I just showed you relative to the two-year-olds, is that in most cases, we can pretty well bank on the fact that if we see higher rates of estrus expression, we're going to do better relative to timed AI pregnancy rates. So the whole idea relative to this area of split-time AI is also based on the question raised here. Is it worth considering a modified approach to AI wherein you can male fertility resulting from fixed-time AI actually be optimized by managing females based on estrus expression prior to fixed-time AI? And could fertility be improved by splitting the AI time for estrus and non-estrus females? So more or less, the whole experimental aim relative to this area was the idea that could a strategy or a management or breeding strategy be developed that would optimize fertility by better managing females that don't express estrus prior to fixed-time AI by more or less delaying insemination of those non-estrus females 20 to 24 hours later. So Jordan was involved with three trials, the first using split-time AI, which really got us off on this track to optimize use of sex-sorted semen. And then the second and third trials were really designed to evaluate the concept of split-time AI using conventional semen in both heifers and cows. In each of these trials, we've used and had the opportunity to work very closely with the group from Estratech. But what's done in these trials is that Estratech patches are administered at the time prostaglandin is administered, and those patches are then read at the time those cows come through for appointment breeding. And essentially what you can see here is that those patches are essentially identified as being activated if roughly 50% or more of that scratch coating has been removed. So in terms of the cow protocols, all the cows went on the 7-day co-sync seeder protocol in Jordan's field trials. And essentially, what you can see here is that the cows that exhibited estrus were inseminated at 66 hours, coincident with the administration of GnRH. And the modification for the non-estrus cows, illustrated in this bottom panel, shows that the GnRH was administered to those non-estrus cows, and then insemination was postponed 20 to 24 hours later. In the case of the heifers, all the heifers went on the 14-day protocol. Same situation relative to what was done with cows. The estrus females inseminated, as you can see here, with GnRH at 66 hours. And the modification for the non-estrus heifers was similar to what was done relative to managing the cows. The outcome from those three different trials are more or less boiled down on the bullet points listed on this slide. The first being that split-time AI increased pregnancy rates by 34% among non-estrus cows inseminated with sex-sorted semen. The second being that split-time AI actually increased pregnancy rates by 15% among non-estrus heifers using conventional semen. And the third point being that no significant improvement in pregnancy rates were observed using split-time with conventional semen in the non-estrus cows. So another student in my program, Breanne Bishop, who also has a poster here, really addressing the questions that are, or the question that's listed on this slide, which more or less relates to, does timing of GnRH administration affect estrus response and or pregnancy rates following split-time AI? And essentially what you can see from this slide, to more or less boil a lot of Breanne's data down, and she can go through that or lead you through that in more detail. The two protocols, again, that we evaluated relative to this work were the 14-day CEDAR protocol for heifers and the 7-day Cosync plus CEDAR protocol in cows. And essentially what you can see from this slide, and if you look at her data to kind of lead you through it, is that what we've learned is, and this is not just our data, but data from George Perry and others in our repro task force group, if those females have actually exhibited estrus at the appointment time or appointed time, there's really no need in giving or administering GnRH to those females. What's been done relative to a recommendation, we've got some brochures that we recently developed, more or less reviewing the whole concept of split-time AI. Any of those non-estrus females, if you're in a position from a management standpoint to really impose split-time AI or use it in your operation, any of those non-estrus females at the appointed time are then held over 24 hours. During that time period, you're going to see an increase in heat expression among those carryover females. And again, those females are not going to need GnRH at the time of insemination. Rather, go ahead and inseminate those and only administer GnRH to the non-responders. So the conclusions, it is to wrap up more or less what I just said and review, it's not necessary to administer GnRH to heifers or cows that express estrus up to 66 or 90 hours. And that's based on the two protocols that I just discussed. And GnRH may be administered concurrent with AI for heifers or cows that fail to express estrus prior to 90 hours. So to kind of wrap things up and consider things in terms of where do we go from here, because I think most of the programs that we're seeing and those that I've discussed this morning with you, we're seeing very good success rates with. And obviously we see ranges, but there's some things that I think we can really consider moving forward in terms of opportunities to perhaps improve results over time. So our group met last night, our task force and leadership team, and I think one of the things as a group collectively, all of the individuals that have contributed to this work, whether it's industry people, academia, whomever, I think one of the things that has really changed the industry in many respects is are these fixed-time AI protocols. And I think if you go back in time relative to these conferences, the first conference was held in 2002 in Manhattan, Kansas. The second one was in 2004 in North Platte, Nebraska. And from the meeting in North Platte, essentially these protocol sheets were developed and they were first released in 2005. So I don't think we can really claim credit for what we see on this graph in terms of beef semen sales in the United States, but suffice to say that what we see having occurred during that time period is almost a doubling of the semen sales, beef semen sales in the United States, going from roughly 4 million units to over 8 million units during the time in which these protocols really began being implemented. So I think that's really exciting for everyone, and I think it opens the door to some new opportunities going forward. So where do we go from here? I think there's several things from a research standpoint that really need to be addressed. I think we need to really expand some of the work that's being done in the Southeast in terms of Bos indicus females, because I think there's some opportunities there to improve results from some of these protocols and perhaps consider things from a different light. I think the next area that really needs to be addressed moving forward is how do we incorporate use of fixed time or perhaps split time insemination in conjunction with use of sex-sorted semen, because I think if we're going to see any uptake in the beef industry relative to use of sex-sorted semen, it's going to have to appear coincident with use of these more restrictive programs that involve more or less a timed approach. And then I think the other thing that should be considered is an effort to really distinguish differences in some of these bulls as to how they perform in these timed programs. Technology transfer is huge, and I think that's one of the things that those of us who have been involved with these programs have been really pleased to see is that we think they've had an impact. Applied reproductive strategies and beef cattle conferences have now been held in a number of states. Next year, for those of you that are ARSBC junkies, we'll be in Manhattan, Kansas next year, and we just made as a group the decision last night. The following year, we'll be in New Mexico. So, I think some things to think about moving forward. I think we need to emphasize use of a lot of these technologies in our programs, whether they're undergraduate, graduate, or veterinary curricula. And I really do think, based on what's occurring nationally, which I don't think that trend is going to be reversed, our extension systems nationally are being downsized. And I think it's really unfortunate from the standpoint of technology transfer in terms of the neat things that are occurring in terms of both reproduction and genomics, that it's occurring at a time coincident when we can really make changes fairly rapidly in the beef industry. And so what that tells me is we really have to expand our linkages with the veterinary community, because they're going to be our partners in terms of transferring this technology to the industry. And so I think that's going to be really important moving forward. I want to take just a couple minutes for some acknowledgments. Our Repro Task Force, I present a lot of data this morning, but there's contributions from all the members of our task force that have really supported implementation and use and development of these protocols, as well as the leadership team, the support from the pharmaceutical houses, as well as all the AI companies. Our group has been fortunate in receiving funding that's really supported a lot of our work from the USDA Competitive Grants Program. And I just highlight again the companies, both in terms of pharmaceutical houses as well as the AI industry, that have really supported this. And in terms of our own work, those individuals, both faculty, students, and staff at Mizzou, as well as all the various companies and individuals that have contributed to our work over the years. So with that, I'm going to wrap things up. I don't know where we're at in terms of time, but we're done. So thanks.